All units proceed to your post assignments. All units proceed to your post assignments.
Is Scott Ritter in the audience? I want to give it up to Scott Ritter. He unfortunately couldn't speak today, but I just want to point out that more than anybody on this stage, Scott is actually someone who knows what it feels like to risk and lose everything, and he did it in order to stand up to the greatest humanitarian catastrophe so far this century, the Iraq War. So thank you, Scott.
Yes, thank you, Scott. And thank you, Kevin, for that lightning speed. Oh, we might have lost Kevin. He has internet issues.
Okay.
Anyway, Scott just back from Washington, D.C., uninvited from the Rage Against the War Machine rally, but not forgotten. The lovely Anya Parampil giving
that was very nice of her. Yeah.
Wasn't it?
We actually had I went down there on Thursday and took my daughter and her fiance out to dinner, and we were joined by Anya and Max and Garland Nixon and Diane Sayre. And so we had a nice dinner. Then we went to Jimmy Dore's live comedy show.
Oh, great.
First time I've ever been to a live comedy show. It was funny as hell, but I mean he was actually
really, sometimes use the F word at these comedy shows. That must have
been
very,
I think, the F word was about the most frequently spoken word there. But it was, I'll tell you what, who else is a up and coming comedian? Max Blumenthal opened for him
with, really?
Oh, a side-splitting comedy. I mean, it was hilarious. So together, it was really a cool show. And then Sarah.
Well, hold on, though. He's not known as a comedian. Was it conventional comedy, or he was just kind of giving a talk as himself?
Oh, no. This was conventional comedy. This guy was doing a stand-up routine. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So it was.
Maybe he is a comedian. I don't know. Okay.
He did a great job. I think that was. I said I went down. When did I go down? I don't even remember when I went down. But I think that was Saturday, and then Sunday was the rally. I think, right? Sunday was the rally.
Yep. We played the video of your speech a half an hour before.
Yeah, 12 noon. Got a big response.
Absolutely.
Thank you for that. Thank you, everybody who helped on that, especially you, Jeff. You turned the ramblings of an old man into something that was artistic. So that was good. But then I was invited to CPI reception.
The Center for Political Innovation.
Did you capture that? Because they treated me very well.
I don't believe that. What do you mean? What are you talking about? Are you exaggerating again?
I might be exaggerating. I don't know. Do we have evidence? But they did it.
He's a hero right here. We love you, Scott. We love you. Go ahead and give us some words.
A Scott chant.
Now, I have to say, in my defense, that was after I ate a very good meal, so I looked like sort of an overinflated beach ball. But I am working on getting in shape.
Oh, yeah. Everybody looks heavier right after they eat, of course.
Right after you eat. But then
an hour later, you were very slender, correct?
Absolutely. That's how it works. But then
that must have been a good feeling. Seriously. I mean, you know. It's not often.
It was a weird feeling. I have to be honest. When I agreed to go to CPI, I thought I was just going to go there and shake hands and talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
Then I came in and they go, no, you've got to deliver the big speech. I said, what speech? The big one. So I had about 5 minute prep time to do that, but it was fun. It was good. And then I went to the big event, where the main people were. And,
oh, you went to the rally?
No. I did a drive-by of the rally, yeah. But I didn't. I'm talking about the post-rally reception. And I got to speak with a lot of the principal speakers. And we had a good talk. There's the future's so bright, Jeff, I got to wear shades. I'm coming out of this thing far more positive than I thought I would.
Okay. All right. Well, we can get into more detail on Friday. In the mean,
I'll be writing a Substack that specifically addresses these issues. So we can talk about it Friday.
Okay. And are you on your new computer or your old computer right now?
It's your question.
Nope. Okay.
Rick's going to be mad at me.
I'm mad at you.
You're mad at me. Did I do something wrong?
Yeah. It's not as good. I'm hearing.
I know, out. but I'm working. That's the problem. See, I can't type on Rick's computer. Anyways, that's a long story.
All right. Let's go to the questions from our beloved audience. And the first three are related. So let's remind folks that this is the lightning round, which means Scott answers all questions in 3 minutes or less, or he gets the whip. And why don't we combine the first three into one answer? A lot of folks want to know about this treaty news. So the first one says Russian President Vladimir Putin has announced the suspension of the last major nuclear disarmament treaty with the United States. This is not a withdrawal, but a suspension of the New START treaty, the Kremlin leader said on Tuesday. What exactly does that mean? And another question, the U.S. betrayed Russia pulling out from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, so Russia now is pulling out. Anything goes now. This is getting out of hand. And Paolo from Portugal, what are the practical consequences of Russia leaving the nuclear treaty?
Yeah, the problems we see today with Russia withdrawing, suspending its participation in New START actually go back to 2001, 2002 when George W. Bush withdrew from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. That was a foundational treaty that created the, you know, a sense of mutual reciprocity when it came, the ultimate form of mutual reciprocity, mutually assured destruction. Meaning if one side launched nuclear weapons, the other side would, both would die, therefore nobody launches nuclear weapons. The United States withdrew from that under the premise that it can build a defense shield. It always told the Russians that this shield was never a threat to Russia, but that was always a lie. As NATO expanded, so did the missile defense systems. Until now, we have two, one in Poland, one in Romania, and then we have a bunch of ships around that operate a missile that when it was first tested in 2000 or in 2012, we told the Russians, don't worry about it, can't shoot down ICBMs. But then in 2015, we tested it against ICBMs. So everything Russia's been afraid of has been justified. Everything we promised has been a lie. In 2018, Putin released a number of new weapon systems, the Sarmat heavy ICBM, the Avangard hypersonic reentry vehicle amongst them. Just the other day, Putin signed those two systems into active duty. That means they're there ready now to defeat anything the United States has. The United States wants to send inspection teams into Russia to investigate, to inspect these two systems, which fall under New START. Russia has denied the ability to send inspectors to the United States because of sanctions. So Russia says, we can't send our inspectors. You're not sending yours. Moreover, you're engaged in a war in Ukraine designed to destroy us. So why would we let you and to inspect the very systems we have fielded to defeat your missile defense system that you put in place after withdrawing from a treaty? Are you high? That's pretty much what you said. You must be smoking from your own stash. But and so he suspended the treaty, saying, we're just not going to play this game right now. You need to. And then they summoned the U.S. ambassador and said, get all your weapons and everything out of Ukraine. We can talk about, you know, fixing the situation in Ukraine. Then we can talk about Maverick's all hyped up too. Then we can talk about the possibility of resuming the treaty. But until that time, we're not going to let you come in, do inspections of our weapons that we put in place to defeat your decision to withdraw from the treaty.
Okay.
The consequences could be fatal, by the way, without arms control, rapid proliferation, arms race, mistake, we all die. This is about the most serious thing that's happened in a long time. This suspension means there is no negotiation for a new treaty. This suspension means that in 2026, when this treaty expires, we will have an arms race. One mistake, we all die. I talked about it in my speech for the Rage Against the War thing. It's dead serious. We had three instances. The hell with that one. We had three instances with where we almost died in the 1980s. And now if that happens again, we will all die. So this is about as serious as it gets.
Okay. And by the way, if you haven't seen Scott's speech, it's on our YouTube channel. It's also on our Substacks, ScottRitterExtra.com. Actually, it's also on Twitter, Twitch, Rumble, and Facebook, too. It's all over the place. All right. Again, a couple of questions. Let's combine them. A lot of folks want to know about Biden's trip. Here's Harry from Leuven. What do you make of the notion that Western leaders, i.e. Biden, asked Russia's permission to visit Kiev? John Dillon, Florida. In your opinion, what were the two most important real reasons Biden went to Ukraine? Do the representatives in D.C. besides Biden know what's really happening on the front? Will we ever know any truth coming from Biden?
And the kids used to come up and reach in the pool and rub my leg down so it was straight and then watch the hair come back up again.
Why? Why? Why did you do that, Jeff? Okay, here's the deal. Nobody travels to Kiev. No Western leader travels to Kiev without clearing with Russia first. Russia, on occasion, launches strikes against Kiev, against critical infrastructure, etc. But Russia's been very careful not to take out, for instance, Kiev train station. You might ask yourself why, 1 year into a war, trains are still running into Kiev, because Russia's not in the business of destroying Ukraine yet. Whenever a Western leader goes into Ukraine, they clear it with the Russians. They say, this is when we're traveling, etc. And Russia, you know, provides diplomatic clearance for them. And so when Biden went in, the U.S. said the president will be traveling during this period of time, deconflict, and the Russians went, we won't attack them. That's just the way it is. Strangest war around. Why did he go? He went for talking points. I mean, there's nothing of substance discussed on the trip. He went there to be seen, to be photographed, to shake hands. And then to go to Warsaw so he could deliver his punchline. I have just been to Kiev. Kiev. Well, I think he said Kiev, you know, using the Ukrainian pronunciation. So he had talking points. But literally nothing came from it. Someone says, is Biden aware? Oh, yeah. Biden has known since September that Ukraine has lost the war. Because in September, Biden was briefed on the ammunition crisis. You know, the one where Ukraine runs out of ammunition this summer and there's nothing the West can do to help him. We don't have production lines. We don't have ammunition. We've used it all. And they run out of artillery ammunition. And in a war that's defined by artillery, when you run out of artillery ammunition, it's not looking good. So Biden knew in September that that this was a dire situation. They're not giving them the tanks they need. Most of the tanks that they're going to send don't work. Can't get out of the garage right now. They're not sending them airplanes. They're not sending them anything because they know come August, September, October, game, set, match, it's all finished. So right now they're trying to put pressure on Russia for some sort of negotiated settlement. But I think by listening to Putin today, I think we can put two and two together. Russia isn't in a negotiating mood. They're in a war-winning mood. And as Putin said, they're going to do whatever it takes to bring this thing to an end on terms that are acceptable to Russia.
Okay. Horacio D. from Malvinas, Argentina. We like movies with good endings. If you made a movie about this war, what ending would you like to see on it?
Well, the ideal ending would be we'd start off with tanks rolling into the Kremlin, parking on the Kremlin line. Well, we'd start with the speech given by, I think, one of the Baltic presidents, that the way this ends is with NATO tanks in the Kremlin. And so we see the tanks coming into the Kremlin and they're rumbling and the music, they're rumbling. And then we back out and we see that they're captured Leopard tanks and captured M1 tanks and captured Ukrainian tanks that are being towed in by victorious Russian soldiers in preparation for the humiliating parade down Red Square of the captured Russian prisoner of war, and mimicking the mockery and the shame that was given to German prisoners of war at the end of the war. That's what I would like to see. I would like to see Ukraine humiliated. I'd like to see their soldiers march down Red Square. I'd like to see their tanks parked out there as war trophies. And I'd like to have NATO sitting back going, holy cow, this didn't end the way we wanted. There's my cinematic movie.
Well, you know, sometimes, actually a lot of times in real life, things turn out like they would in a movie. Do you think that might be the case?
I don't know. I don't think the Russians are as petty as I am. I think the Russians are actually pretty good diplomats, and they, you know, they'll do what they need to do to win this war. And then I think they'll be looking forward to finding a way to peacefully coexist with their neighbors. I, on the other hand, am a very petty kind of guy, and I would definitely drag their tanks into Red Square and let dogs pee on them.
Okay. I can be petty too. I was very petty when I scolded Gonzalo Lira today, and somebody scolded me for going down into the gutter with him. But sometimes it just feels like the thing to do. He's finding new ways to be an asshole, by the way. New ways.
Is he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. This time he blamed you because somebody is stealing content from other podcasts, and they put you with McGregor, and he blamed you for it. He said, why are you on your channel making it seem like you appeared with McGregor when you didn't? But it wasn't even your channel. It was somebody else's. So, like I said, finding new ways to be an asshole.
I was yeah. caught. I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, I know. It's hard to even follow. All right, let's go on to the next question from Sandra, or maybe it's Sandra from North Carolina. What if, after losing in Ukraine, the West will simply refuse to admit defeat and go on telling their people we won? Unless they are physically in Ukraine, the general public will not know any better and will readily believe the narrative the West has won.
Well, we've already done that historically. Vietnam, peace with honor. We won. We won. Let's go home. Afghanistan, that was the best damn withdrawal the world's ever seen. I mean, we put 12,000 guys in the Kabul airport, and boy, did they do a good job. I mean, when that last airplane lifted off, did you see the general walking on that last plane? I mean, what a hero. We won that war. No, we didn't win that war. And the same thing's going to happen here. We're going to come up with something about, I don't know. You know, it's going to be something like out of Arnhem when the British paratroopers jumped in and the bridge too far, and they got surrounded, cut up and all that stuff. And then the few survivors made it out, and we sent guys across in boats to bring them back. And the mere fact that they rescued some of these British paratroopers became a great thing. We have victory. And so maybe at some point in time, we'll have surviving Ukrainian forces being brought over the Dnieper River in boats, and they'll be greeted and hugged as the war comes to an end. It's a great victory. There's no way to spin this. The United States is going to lose. NATO is going to lose. The West is going to lose. And Russia is going to win.
Robeson X in Barcelona. What do you make of the fairly recent helicopter crash killing the Minister of Internal Affairs and his leadership team, combined with the so-called anti-corruption purges of high-ranking officials, the raid on Kolomoisky's home, and the curious sparing of the totally corrupt Reznikov? What's really going on here?
Politics as usual in Ukraine, the most corrupt nation in the world with the most corrupt politicians. You know, it's interesting when the helicopter got shot with the Minister of Interior and his deputy and others. First, they said it was a crash. First, they said it might have been shot down. Then they said, no, the official investigation was a crash. Now it turns out it was shot down. I mean, I don't know. I don't have part of the investigation, but then they said mistaken identity, although the helicopter's flying the same route it flies all the time. Mistaken identity, who knows? There's Ukraine's literally the most corrupt nation in the world right now, and when you saturate corruption, organized crime, gangs, I mean, we saw this at the beginning of the conflict in Kiev when they handed out AK-47s to everybody. Suddenly there were videos of people setting roadblocks, and they were killing their competitors. They were killing, other gang members. Gunfights. Everybody's going, oh, they're fighting Russian saboteurs. No, they're not. These are gang guys killing gang guys. It was insane because it's the most corrupt nation on the face of the earth. And clearly, the Minister of Interior, think about what that job entails and all the corruption opportunities that are there for him to dip in and steal some of the billions of dollars sending over there. And he obviously pissed off some people. So, bam, dead. They raid Kolomoisky's home. They don't want him being involved in creating a political enterprise on how to divvy up the money. Zelensky is the most corrupt president there has ever been in Ukraine. And that says a lot because every president in Ukraine has been corrupt. But no president has been afforded a $100 billion gift, a pie to be divvied up and apportioned out. These Ukrainian politicians are the richest people on the planet right now because they're just getting free money. They don't even have to have a printing press. We print it for them and just give it to them. This is disgusting. And if you're an American out there, wake up, guys. The money we're giving Ukraine isn't helping anybody except the politicians, the corrupt politicians. The Ukrainian soldiers are getting slaughtered right now. Slaughtered because half the stuff we send, 60% of the stuff we send them, they're not getting. So that's what I think.
Right. And as you pointed out last week, compare and contrast to how everybody is turning a blind eye to this corruption when Biden is in office. When Trump merely vaguely said, hey, President Zelensky, maybe it'd be nice if you investigated something, that was cause for impeachment. That as if Ukraine is pure. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. All right, let's move on to the next question. Miko from Serbia, how do you see the EU and NATO 5 years from today? If you were an advisor to some government of Western Balkans EU candidate countries, would you advise them to start pivoting towards the BRICS and SCO?
Short answer, yes. If I'm a developing country, a developing economy, and I want to be thriving in 5 years, BRICS and SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization. I want to be with winners. I want to be with the people that are planning on building good infrastructure, that are working on cooperative ways to work together and partnerships. Yeah, I know China's not perfect. I know sometimes they provide loans with harsh repayment terms. But gosh, when was the last time the United States went in and said, what, you owe us $100 billion and you can't pay it off? All right, we'll write off that loan. China's done that. China's gone in and said, yeah, we'll write off that loan. No problem. I mean, they're not perfect, but they're not evil. They're trying to literally, you know, develop a developing world so that they can economically benefit from it. You can't benefit from a bankrupt nation. The United States can, because our job is not to develop. Our job is to destroy. But no, if I were a developing country, last place I'd go is the EU. It's a broken system. Where do I see it in 5 years? Probably on life support. I'm not going to say it's going to be totally dead, but probably on life support. It depends what happens in Germany. We have this whole Nord Stream 2 thing. I'm sure, Jeff, you have a question about that down the road, so I won't get too much into Nord Stream 2. But, you know, once Germany wakes up to the fact the United States actually did attack it, this is going to cause problems with both NATO and the EU. NATO is a sick, broken country. It has no defense right now, none whatsoever. That's the truth that's come out of here. All these people that said they had tanks they want to give to Ukraine have now gone into the warehouses and found out the mice have eaten all the wiring. They can't start the tanks. They don't work. What tanks are we going to give them? 10 here, 3 here, 1 there, 2 there, but not 100, not 700 that Biden's been promising. They don't have any ammunition, none, zero. They don't have the ability to produce the ammunition because they haven't been in the ammunition production business. They can't afford to do anything. Other people are fat. I mean, I'm not picking on them too much, but I am. Find me German soldiers that aren't fat. Scott, go to the special forces. Okay, what, 3, 4, 5, 50, 100? But I'm talking about the vaunted German army, the one that's going to scare the crap out of everybody. They don't have any tanks at work. They don't have any infantry fighting vehicles at work. And everybody's eating schnitzels and, you know, donuts. You know, they wouldn't survive 3 days in, you know, harsh combat conditions. They have to go back. Their union says they have to go back to a, you know, heated or air-conditioned barracks and, you know, be able to dance with women all night long. I don't know. But they're not warriors. And there's no nation in Europe that has warriors right now. None. Not in NATO. Not in NATO.
Dazed and confused and la-la man. When the U.S. or NATO sends in advisors or trainers for Ukraine, what does that actually mean? What do those people specifically do? Also, is their role the same as trainers and advisors during Korea and Vietnam, or is the function now completely different?
Well, I don't believe that neither the U.S. nor NATO have officially sent in trainers or advisors into Ukraine. I believe the official training is taking place outside of Ukraine. I think unofficially, covertly, there is some sort of logistics support that's taking place using subcontractors or sheep-dipped people, you know, who are operating inside Ukraine on a limited basis. But the people you see on the ground in Ukraine are primarily mercenaries or private military contractors, another term for mercenary, who are going in there ostensibly to train. The mercenaries are going to fight. The PMCs are supposed to be going into training, like Mozart was before it disbanded. This is very uncoordinated, chaotic. Andy Milburn, Marine Corps colonel, who I know and respect, went over and took over Mozart. He created it, and it's just been a disaster. And I'm watching this and watching a friend suffer because something's going on there. He's not the professional he used to be. He appears to be drunk. He appears to be out of control. And his organization is just a joke. So bad that the Ukrainians are saying, get the mad American out of here. So you're not helping Ukrainians when you do this. You're actually providing them with crap training, and then they go off and they die. And if you get too close to the front lines, you die. And that's my point to all the Americans that are over there right now. Go home, because you're going to die otherwise. You're not doing the right thing. You're doing the wrong thing. And the Russians, once this thing gets kicking, they're going to kill you. And you don't want to get captured, because then you're a war criminal and you'll be prosecuted. So go home. Do the smart thing. Go home.
Okay. By the way, Kevin Michalizzi is handling your backstage duties today, and we appreciate that. Paul from Switzerland. How many Ukrainians, pro-Russian Ukrainians, lest there be any doubt, fight on Russia's side? Are there any estimates out there?
Well, it's interesting. What defines a Ukrainian? Because prior to the referendum for independence, and then the referendum to join Russia, everybody in Donetsk and Donbass was a Ukrainian. Everybody in Zaporizhia and Kherson was a Ukrainian. Now, that might be ethnic Russians, but they were Ukrainians. And so when you talk about the Donetsk People's Militia, the Lugansk People's Militia, you talk about volunteer units that were being formed in Zaporizhia and Kherson. These were Ukrainians, legally speaking, Ukrainians who were fighting on behalf of Russia in what was occupied Ukraine. Now it's Russia, and they have Russian citizenship. So, if you'd asked me a number of months ago, the number would be this big. If you ask me now, the number is very small. Here's the deal. If you're an ethnic Russian and of Ukrainian citizenship, but you go over to join the Russians, you're sort of saying, I'm a Russian, not a Ukrainian. So I don't imagine if there's people who continue to identify themselves as Ukrainians fighting for the Russians. I think that number would be rather small. I'm not saying it's impossible, but I think that number is rather small. I think the vast majority of people who are fighting for the Russians, who are not from the Russian Federation, but from that region, identify as Russians. And in many cases, because of the absorption of these territories, legally are Russians.
Okay, good answer, Major. Catherine from Vermont, the great state of Vermont. Can you please comment on the financial component of the period leading up to the 2014 coup? Newland's F the EU comments seems related to EU attempts to one-up a 2013 Russia-Ukraine financial partnership. Wasn't the coup the U.S.'s response to a perceived threat of closer Russia-Ukraine cooperation?
Okay, Catherine, good question. I will give the best answer I can get. It's not going to be detailed oriented. It's going to be broad brush. Broad brush, at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union collapsed, Ukraine became an independent entity. Russia was an independent entity. But the fact is, their economies were like this. You couldn't separate the two. And so there was a period of time where Russia and Ukraine were working on developing sort of economic sovereignty for Ukraine, but it was very difficult to do. And Ukraine had, if once it became an independent nation, there was debt. Russia assumed responsibility for that debt, freeing them up. But Ukraine's a very corrupt nation. So Ukraine lagged in terms of economic development compared to even Russia of the 90s, was better than Ukraine of the 90s. So the Ukrainians were looking to pivot away from Russia. And so they started courting the European Union to become members of the European Union, join that community. But in order to do that, they had to basically get Russia to agree to help them sever relations from economic relations with Russia. Basically, they needed Russia to underwrite the cost of pivoting to the EU. And Russia said, can't do that. You can pivot to the EU if you want to. We're not paying that price. And so this led to the crisis where it appeared that Yanukovych backed out. He had promised that he would help pivot to the EU, but then when the conditions became such that he couldn't do it, he went back to Russia and worked on developing a closer economic relationship with Russia. The United States didn't like the EU infringing on it. So when the United States orchestrated the coup, they did so in a manner which had total disregard for the EU's concerns, the EU's desires to have close economic relations. The U.S. wasn't looking for, you know, a normalized Ukraine. The U.S. was looking for a radicalized Ukraine designed to break up the Ukrainian-Russian economic relationship and to empower radical right-wing Ukrainian ultra-nationalists who would then begin the process of creating the chaos and anarchy and dissonance, the violence that led to the current conflict. So that's my short, broad-brushed answer.
Okay. Susan from Fayetteville, Tennessee. Will Biden close the borders when or if we go to war?
Well, I think the fair question to ask, to answer, is that did Biden close the borders, COVID-19? The answer is yes. So I would imagine any time an international crisis emerges where free travel isn't seen as beneficial to the security of the United States from the perspective of the U.S. government, then the borders can be closed. I'm sure there will be court challenges. I'm sure people will, there will be exceptions made, but the U.S. is it's a sovereign country. We control our borders, and if any time we decide that we need to shut down traffic across the borders, we'll do it.
Okay, let's take one more of the questions that have been submitted in advance and then go to some live questions. If you would like to submit your question in advance for upcoming episodes, you can do that at scottritterextra.com. Just click on Ask the Inspector when you get there and you'll see how to do it. William McQuaid from Seattle. Sweden cleaned up the Nord Stream pipeline debris you said would expose exactly who blew up the pipeline, but of course they won't say. Will the U.S. now pretend Russia stole massive amounts of C4 from the U.S. to blow up the pipeline and keep deceiving the world this way?
Well, the interesting thing about C4 is that when it's produced in all explosives of this nature, when they're produced, each batch has a unique signature put into it. And it helps the ATF and the FBI and others investigate, crimes that could be committed with this. The U.S., although the U.S. does have what we call a sanitized C4, meaning that it has no. But the big thing that we like to use is explosives that are sourced from other nations. We really like to use Czech-made Simtex back in the day because if it went off, be traced back to a Warsaw Pact country. So I would imagine that if the CIA was involved in this, as Seymour Hersh's reporting suggests, that they would be using sanitized or they would be using false flag type C4. But again, everything has a signature. Everything can be traced. Let's say the Russians got a hold of that the residue, or in this case, it appears that at least one device didn't go off. So there should be an intact C4 charge that Sweden recovered, or Russia recovered before Sweden, but I don't think Russia got there before Sweden. And that charge will have everything. For instance, according to Hersh's article, the process of desalinization of the charge to create a neutral charge, et cetera, that's a specific process that if you reverse engineer the chemistry of the substance, you'll be able to find out the specific processes, and then that's a fingerprint that can be used to identify who did it. And trust me, the CIA is not as clever as they think they are, and they make mistakes all the time. And I'm confident that the debris will point direct finger back at the United States of America. Remember, the CIA is the people that put 20 people to Italy. They kidnapped somebody, and they used their own damn cell phones, and the Italian government was able to round up the whole network just by getting the cell phone. They're not that smart.
All right. By the way, apologies to the audience. We started a half an hour late today, and we thank you for sticking with us. I see we have a pretty large audience watching live, and thanks to Kevin Michalizzi.
That was my fault, by the way. I had a schedule conflict because I am my own scheduler, and sometimes I make mistakes. So thank you, Jeff, and thank the audience for...
And special thanks to Kevin, who's in Crimea, where it's very late, and he adapted to circumstances. We appreciate that. And Kevin, you got some live questions for us? From Vlad in Florida. Thanks for the donation, Vlad. Scott, your take on the multiple explosions of factories and railroad accidents this month. Florida has had three this week, and no explanation what's causing this.
Again, I think I've made it clear I'm not a big fan of conspiracy theorists. I believe in, you know, reality. And the unfortunate reality is the United States has crap infrastructure. Trains derail because we don't maintain our trains. The rail line, the quality of rail lines in America sucks. But the expense of repairing the rails are too much for the rail industry, which, by the way, what I learned the other day is it literally is the most profitable business in America today. So they're making all this money, they're not putting anything back into repairing the rails. And so we're playing Russian roulette every time a train goes down. And I have to tell you, living right here, we had a CSX rail yard right here. And there had been accidents. It's not nice living within the evacuation range. Don't ever buy one of those hazmat guidebooks and then read all the stuff that goes through your neighborhood and then read the evacuation radius if things go bad. You realize you're screwed because almost everything that goes through there, if there's an accident, you got to be evacuated. No, America has crap infrastructure. This is an embarrassment. It's a national embarrassment. But we can send $100 billion to Ukraine.
All right. Sergey, this is pronounced, I've been saying it wrong the whole, oh, there it is. Thank you. How do you say it? Sergey or Sergey?
Serge.
Now that's how I've been saying it all. What is it, Kevin?
Sergey.
Sergey. Okay. Yeah. I've been saying Serge the whole time and he's a nice man. Oh. So he let it slide. Sergey.
He whipped you.
Yeah. Right. Or I'll whip myself. All right. You got any more questions for us? Thanks for the donation, by the way, Sergey. Sergey. Oh, I don't know why I have so much trouble with that. T. Jesky. Scott, who will first declare defeat? Zelensky or the Ukrainian army?
I happen to believe that there are still honorable people in the Ukrainian army, military people who, military professionals, who when confronted with the absolute reality that continued resistance is futile and all they're doing is putting the lives of their soldiers and the lives of Ukraine's civilians at risk, that they will be the ones to say enough is enough. Zelensky is not a man of honor. He's a desperate politician who's playing this game out till the bitter end to make as much money as he can. If he thinks he can actually win right now, no. I think right now he's doing what he can to basically build the biggest stash he can. And the same thing with all those other politicians. None of these people love Ukraine. None of these people believe in Ukraine. That's the other thing that people need to get through their heads. When you put that stupid little Ukrainian flag, and I don't mean stupid because it's a Ukrainian flag. I mean, you're stupid for putting it on your social media and flying around. Someone gave it to me. Virtue signaling.
Yes.
They do it all around here. I mean, I drive around and people are hanging Ukrainian flags. And I'm like, do you even know what the hell you're doing? What that stands for? And do you understand by putting it out there, all you're doing is encouraging the process of elongation of a conflict that's going to kill hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, displace tens of thousands of people, and destroy the nation you claim to love? All you guys who put the Ukrainian flag out there, unless you're from Ukraine and you have relatives fighting in Ukraine, you're not helping. You're not helping at all.
Yeah, the pathetic need to feel superior. All right. These questions are coming in live, by the way, on YouTube and Facebook. Rune Larson to Scott. Now, there's a novel approach. A question for Scott. No official war has been declared yet. Why? Good question.
Well, remember when this conflict started, from the Ukrainian perspective, it was an internal civil war. It was between Ukraine and the ethnic Russian separatists, who they called terrorists. Remember, in April 2014, they published a law. They basically declared war on the ethnic Russians of Ukraine. But this was an internal conflict. Russia made it a special military operation by citing Article 51, preemptive collective self-defense, but it wasn't a war. There was no declaration of war. It was simply a preemptive attack to eliminate an imminent threat to their collective security arrangement. NATO says they're not a party to the conflict, so NATO's never going to declare war. Although NATO is an active participant, unacknowledged, but realistically so, nobody wants to declare us a war, because once you declare it a war, you're taking it to the other level. Who's going to declare war against whom? Is Ukraine really going to declare war against Russia and up that ante? Because once Russia is liberated by a declaration of war, everything changes. Right now, it's still a special military operation, so there's certain constraints put in place, like the ones we saw with allowing Joe Biden to travel to Kiev, like the fact that anybody could travel to Kiev, like the fact that Zelensky's still alive. You know, all of these things point to the fact that this has not risen to the level of war yet. So I think everybody is desperately trying to avoid crossing that rhetorical line, because there are real consequences attached to that term.
Okay. As usual, we're streaming live on Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, and Rumble. But we can only insert comments that are coming in live from YouTube and Facebook. Kevin, are you still there?
There we go.
What is the START treaty? Is it true that almost all American nuclear weapons are in use beyond their originally intended service lives?
The START treaty is a strategic arms reduction treaty. The first START treaty was signed on July 31st of 1991, and I believe it expired in 2009. There was a START II treaty that was negotiated afterwards, focused on demerving the systems. It was signed, but it was never ratified. One of the reasons why it wasn't ratified is because of the cancellation of the APM treaty by the anti-ballistic missile treaty by George W. Bush. So the the Russian Duma refused to ratify, but both parties agreed that even though the treaty wasn't ratified, that they would comply with the demerving requirements. START III was another treaty designed to get numbers down from 2,500 down to 1,700, but they didn't even get out of the starting block, because without missile defense being factored in, nobody would talk. The Bush administration came up with something, an interim agreement called SORT, a Strategic Offensive Reduction Treaty, like a couple pages long, no verification of compliance. It was just basically a vehicle that allowed both sides to bring their numbers down to the desired level without going through a treaty process that neither side was going to ratify. But when START I expired in 2009 and SORT was getting ready to expire in 2012, they realized they needed a new treaty vehicle. So new START was negotiated by the Obama administration. And new START is the current treaty that we have right now, the new Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. It brought back on-site inspection, 18 on-site inspections a year, specific kinds of inspections, verification requirements, et cetera, numbers down. But again, no ballistic missile defense linkage. But that's where we are. On the weapons, Putin in his speech mentioned that the United States is talking about potentially doing new nuclear weapons tests. Yes. As nuclear weapons age, I'm not going to get into nuclear weapons design here, but there are things that happen to the system, to the components, that cause deterioration. And then once you have to start replacing things, you don't have assurances now that the weapon's going to function the way it was supposed to. So ideally, what you would like to do is when you make these modifications, you take some of these weapons and you test them to make sure they function the way they are. And if you do get those weapons to function, assumptions can be made about the other weapons. But again, as they get older, boom. So right now, everything's done by computer simulation. And we have really good computers. They simulate very well, but the confidence level isn't there. You really want, if you're going to use a nuke, it needs to work as advertised when you use it. And right now the feeling is they don't. And so there's a lot of pressure in the United States put on ourselves to start doing limited underground testing of nuclear weapons for stockpile verification. And the Russians have just said, if the United States does that, then we're going to do it too, because of course Russia has the same issues. So you know, Putin has told the Ministry of Defense to be prepared to carry out underground testing if the United States were to cross that barrier. Now, to me, the best thing to do is if you have nuclear weapons that are aging and not used, get rid of them. Don't replace them. And maybe we can get to the point where we don't have nuclear weapons. But we're going to, you know, that's not going to happen, so, at least not for the near future.
Okay, Matthew Cunningham, when will we have Maverick merchandise? Soon. You want to answer that also? I say soon.
Yes, sir. Soon.
All right. And also the way to buy Scott's book autographed soon. I promise. Vitaly Bilovitsky, thank you for your donation. All caps, so you know it's an important question. Why does Russia occupy Kherson and Zaporizhia?
Land bridge to the Donbass, connect Crimea with the Donbass in Russia, to secure the water supply of Crimea, which was cut off by the Ukrainian government in 2014, to protect the ethnic Russians that live there from continued deprivations by a nationalist-dominated Ukrainian government that has shown a proclivity to rape, murder, and otherwise brutalize ethnic Russians. To provide strategic depth to Crimea so that it isn't going to be attacked by Ukraine. I mean, we can go on all day long, man. So, you know, why? Because Ukraine made a decision to kill ethnic Russians, to brutalize ethnic Russians in Zaporizhia and Kherson as part of southern of Yuzhnaya Russia, Novaya Russia, New Russia. I mean, and you think Russia's going to stop there? Last I saw, there were some arrows coming down out of Russia towards Kharkov. It ain't going to be called Kharkiv anymore. It's going to be called Kharkov. And I think soon those arrows might be pointed towards Odessa, which will always be called Odessa, but they might put the statue of Catherine the Great back up there. You know, why does Russia do what it's doing? Because Ukraine decided to declare war against the ethnic Russian population of Ukraine. That's why. If Ukraine didn't want this to happen, they shouldn't have declared war against ethnic Russians. They should have treated a significant percentage of their population with respect. Instead, they call them Muskol, orcs, treat them as subhumans. You expect Putin to do anything less than this? You expect Russia to do anything less than this? And you don't know Putin, you don't know Russia.
Okay, so you're saying you can't think of very many good reasons.
No, I just made it up. I was like,
okay.
That's what I do.
We have time for a few more questions coming in live. Here's one from YouTube. And Gregor wants to know as follows. NATO members say that they will buy ammunition for Ukraine. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, if somebody produced something in limited quantities and all of those were gone and nobody's producing them, me saying that I just came upon $100,000 and I'm going to go out and buy some of that stuff. How much of that am I going to buy? Nothing. Because it ain't being made anymore. Where are we going to buy this ammunition from? You know, I mean, NATO's saying we have the money. We'd like to go out and buy this stuff, but it's 155 millimeter ammunition. Where are they going to buy it from? And then who's going to produce it in the quantities necessary and in the timeline necessary to meet Ukraine's needs? By the time NATO solves this problem, there ain't going to be a Ukrainian military anymore. Now, if Russia fails to make the Ukrainian military submit by the end of the summer, early fall, then there's the potential that, you know, NATO will be able to have sourced ammunition supplies and bring it up. And then that's a, now we come back to, what's that ugly word I like to use, Jeff? Game changer. You know, so a Russian failure to bring an end to this conflict come the end of summer, early October, will become a game changer. Because that means that, one, Ukraine has shown the ability to withstand whatever it is Russia's getting her throw at them. That would be bad news for Russia. And two, Ukraine will now be reinforced with new weapons, ammunition, et cetera, that could possibly be turned to its advantage. So, you know, I will straight up say that if Russia doesn't do what I think Russia's capable of doing, Russia could be in trouble. But I have a funny feeling Russia's going to do what I think Russia's capable of doing.
Well, what if the U.S. were in a real war, you know, not one of these proxy wars, but where we needed the ammunition? Are you saying we'd be stuck too, or we have stockpile that we're holding on to?
Well, remember, we have to be able to fight wars. And I don't know, there's this thing called China out there that we're making big noise about. And then there's this thing called Korea. You know, we're in the South and there's the North Koreans up there. And we have military contingency plans there. A contingency plan that just exists on paper is useless. A contingency plan has to be linked to actual forces that are identified. Those forces have weapons that are real and ammunition and fuel and everything. So we have to have stockpiles capable of matching each one of our contingencies separate from each other. We can't have one contingency that we can go, we can either go here or we can go here. Then we don't have a contingency. So where we're at right now is we have eaten through our training supplies. We've eaten through some of our strategic reserves. And now we're eating into the actual contingency ammunition, which what we're finding out isn't enough because we never thought that modern war would be fought on this scope and this scale. General Cavulli, the NATO, the senior, he's a lieutenant general, senior American general in Europe, commander of European forces for NATO, just admitted last month. He said, we didn't imagine what war was like. We beyond our imagination, we're not ready for this. We don't have the ability to fight that. We don't have the ammunition. Even if they hadn't given everything to Ukraine, the fact is you're chewing through 20, 30, 40,000 rounds a day. And NATO can't match that. NATO will run out of ammunition that quick. We don't have the ability to do that. We have to actually start making more ammunition to get our existing stockpiles up to speed now that we know that modern war is going to require high expenditures of ammunition.
Okay, thanks for clarifying. Let's take a couple more live questions. We have over 4,400 people watching live right now. And Kevin is demonstrating his startling alacrity, lightning speed.
Or we lost Kevin.
Maybe we did. Let's see if I can find something. See, it's hard for me to read the questions, but I'm just going to take a guess here on this one. What do you think about the dredging of the Bastro Canal done by Ukrainians? What's the purpose? There is also talk of an American military base there.
I don't know. Okay. I have to figure out what the Bastro Canal is. I don't know.
All right.
Let me see. People are going, some expert you are. Okay. Sorry. I don't know what it is.
When the war is over, will Ukraine become a part of Russia? Will the people of Ukraine accept that? And what happens to Zelensky?
We'll work in reverse order. What's happened to Zelensky? Dead or exiled? Will the Ukrainian people become part of Russia? No. Ethnic Russians will become part of Russia. But Ukrainian people will be part of whatever rump state remains. And will they be happy about it? They don't have much of a choice. This is terrible what's happening in Ukraine. A modern nation state's being destroyed, but it was a dysfunctional state to begin with, a fake state. People are trying to, at the beginning when Putin was like, it's a fake state, everybody's like, nah, you're full of it, man. Now everybody's going, Western Ukraine doesn't belong to Ukraine. Snap, sort of. Part and parcel being a fake state. Novorossiya is where the Russians live. They don't want to be part. Oh, gosh. So isn't that part of a fake state? So we just identified that Western Ukraine doesn't want to be part of Ukraine and Eastern Ukraine doesn't want to be part of Ukraine. In the middle. Confused people in the middle. Are they Ukrainian? Are they Russian? Are they not? Who knows? But that's what's going to be left if this war continues out. This little kernel. They won't even have access to the Black Sea. Pathetic little agrarian nation. And will they be happy about it? Well, they should be fortunate to be alive, but they won't be happy about their circumstance. They'll be very unhappy about it because they won't be what they used to be. But this is the tragic reality of a nation that chooses the course that it's currently on. And everybody says, well, they didn't choose it. Yeah, you did. You voted for Zelensky. He's still in power. The fact that he's still in power means that the voters are either waiting for the next election, which means the situation's not dire enough, or they don't have the courage to stand up and take matters in their own hands. Revolutions do happen. People, Scott, you expect to. Revolutions do happen, baby. 1775, we decided we didn't want the crown. We stood up, we revolted. There's been revolutions. 1917, Russians went, screw you, Tsar, we're taking over, the Bolsheviks. Others went, screw you, Bolsheviks, we're going to fight you. And then there was a civil war. I'm just saying that when nations are subjected to the kind of turmoil that Ukraine is subjected to, this is the time for a revolution. If you're Ukrainian right now and you're listening to this, and you think Zelensky's screwing you, and he is, and you don't want to die in the Bakhmut meat grinder, and you don't want to. Time to rise up, guys. Civil War, revolution. Take matters in your own hand. But otherwise, you will get that which fate has, you know, will deal you, and you won't like it. You won't like it at all.
All right. I see Kevin's back. Kevin's having internet problems, but he looks like he's back. So let's take a couple more questions. We still have a very large live audience. Days, why has Russia failed to take Bakhmut?
Well, you do know that, and see, he's got a little lappy signed in fire. So that tells you the nature of the question. He's like making fun of Russia. And I see his other questions too. So this guy's a dick.
But at least that's okay. Say LOL.
I'll answer your question, Days. You know, the battle for Bakhmut has been going on since May. It's a meat grinder. If you're such a brave son of a bitch, Dave, why aren't you there? Oh, you'd be dead, which is why maybe Russia hasn't taken it yet, because it's a very heavily defended piece of terrain. The Ukraine's been thrown in everything they have to hold on to this. They're still losing, Days. They're still losing. If you don't think they're losing, go visit it, tour, take your family. Don't take your family. But you go, because you're such a brave son of a bitch. You go to Bakhmut. And then if you come back and you're not missing an eye, an arm, a leg, gut shot, come back and tell us how wonderful it is, you son of a bitch. Why hasn't Russia taken Bakhmut? Because it's a hell of a fight. You know, Prigozhin talks about Wagner, and he says, the guys we're fighting right there have bigger balls than you, Days. He's speaking highly of the Ukrainians because they're putting up a hell of a fight in some heavily defended terrain, Days. And yet the Russians are still winning. Days, little laugh emoji, that pile of shit, that whatever you want. Don't sit here and play stupid games, you cowardly. Never mind. I'm sorry.
Pissant. How about that? You were searching for one more word. I like pissant. I've been using that.
Pissant. I would have, if I were thinking rationally rather than letting my emotions get my head.
Because yeah. It's not swearing, but it's a nasty insult. All right. Everything a-okay. Scott, isn't it your hang on 1 second here. Isn't it your opinion that the United States as of now is implementing a sort of last resort policy of ceding instability against Europe, Russia, China, anyone who threatens its supremacy?
I wouldn't have thought that before. I think we've had this conversation, or I've had similar conversations. You know, there's an economist out there named Michael Hudson. And when I first heard his theories, I was like, a little too conspiratorial for me, about how the United States is using this conflict to bring down German and European Union, sort of an indirect approach. But then I take a look at the attack on Nord Stream, and there's no other way to explain it. Literally, there's no other way to explain it, because it's literally an attack on Germany and on the European Union by the United States, which tells me that, because you can't, you know, an attack of that magnitude cannot be undertaken without full knowledge of what the potential consequences were. This isn't an accident. This isn't like, you know, a high school chemistry experiment gone awry, you know. I just decided I was going to put a little bit of this in there. Boom. No, this is deliberate action by a nation state at the highest level. Considering this, they had to know what they were doing. They had to know what the consequences are. So therefore, we come back to your question. And it certainly looks like it. Certainly looks like the United States, because you can't say that this was a well thought. Blowing up Nord Stream was an act of desperation, a literal act of desperation. It backfired, by the way. It didn't go the way they went, except for the damage to Germany. But did they honestly think that damaging Germany, that Germany would take it? No. Well, that's been what's happening. But I have a funny feeling that the Germans are starting to ask questions, that they're going to jump to the realization that the United States attacked them. And then NATO's at play. European Union's at play. That seems to me the last direction the United States would want to go. If you're desperate, you want to do things to make yourself stronger, not weaker. I don't know. This is very confusing. I mean, we are in confusing times. Nord Stream is one of these geopolitical mind busters, because the more you think about it, just the crazier it gets.
All right, let's take one more question and call it an episode. Turla Irwin, very few tanks on the Russian MOD daily reports of late. Have they run out? Was that the urgency? Are they holding them back, or a bit of both?
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the Russian claims of tanks, there's over 7,000 tanks destroyed. Just chew on that for a minute. Over 7,000 tanks have been destroyed. Ukraine started this conflict with, what, 2,000? That means that more than 5,000 tanks have been provided to Ukraine, and they've been destroyed. So when you look at it, I think I read somewhere that it's estimated that Ukraine has around 600, 800 tanks left. That's not enough to do what they, it's still a lot of tanks. I mean, I'm sitting here going 600, 800 tanks. That's a lot of tanks. But it's not sufficient. Plus they had to pull a lot of these tanks out to secure Kiev. If you take a look at the videotapes coming out of the Belarus border, you see some of the best armor units in Ukraine up there, you know, defending up there. And the few tanks that are left, they aren't going to throw away in the meat grinder. They're going to pull back for reserves just in case these other tanks do come in from the West, et cetera. So I think the fact that you see very few tanks on the front line is indicative of a couple things. One, most of their tanks have been destroyed, Ukrainian tanks. Two, what few tanks they have left are being held in reserve or deployed for other strategic contingencies. Three, we go back to number one. Most of the tanks have been destroyed.
All right. That does it for this week's episode of Ask the Inspector. I wanted to ask you more about Caleb Maupin and the Center for Political Innovation, but maybe we can save that for Friday night. Is that going to be part of your article? I'm very curious about
it. It is, but I mean, I can spend a couple minutes talking about it if people don't mind. I had never met Caleb before. I knew who he was. I knew that he was somebody who helped organize the Occupy Wall Street movement. I know that he comes from a very radical political belief. And as I told CPI when I spoke to them, I couldn't think of two people further apart politically than them who are literal communists, and me, who's not. But we found common cause. And that common cause is a desire to take on the war machine, if you want to, a military-industrial complex, et cetera. You know, but I don't judge people by their politics anymore. I used to. I when I was young, I mean, I fell into the label business and all that. I judge people by the quality of their character and, you know, and their commitment to their cause. I mean, even if I don't agree with the cause, I can evaluate people as quality people by saying, you're really dedicated. These guys are believers. They work hard. They believe in it. They're honorable people. And I think, as far as what you and I are trying to do is in regards to arms control, they're on board. They're all on board, and they're not bringing, they understand that to join this train we're moving here. When you buy the ticket, you leave your political baggage behind. You're joining this train to accomplish a mission that we all agree should be accomplished. Maverick's on board.
Well, everybody who's anybody is on board. So unlike
I have a lot of respect for these guys. I give them top-notch people.
Good. Well, that's what I was hoping to hear. And so you've satiated my curiosity. Unlike those other nitwits who subject people who should be allies to purity tests, just ridiculous. So I'm glad things turned out as well as they did. In fact, let's watch it one more time. This was a surprise talk by Scott, who was just hanging out that they asked him to give a talk. Beautiful. You deserve it, Scott. So happy that that happened. So join us on Friday night for the loquacious version of Ask the Inspector. That's at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Scott answers questions much more extensively then. We're usually on for about 2 hours. And please join us on Sunday also for our other podcast, which is Scenes from the Evolution with Kevin Michalitzi and Tori Mansfield. And thanks to Kevin for handling the backstage duties today, starting a half an hour late, battling internet problems and everything. And thanks.
I'd like to say something to Scott before we close.
All right.
As a guy who defended our motherland in his earlier career, and somebody who defends everybody's motherland these days, I'm 2 days early, but since I won't see you on Thursday, I want to say have a blessed Defenders Day on Thursday.
Well, thank you very much. Just a news flash. I'm going to be attending the Defenders Day celebration as a guest of the Russian ambassador. I accepted because, holy cow, get to go to the Russian embassy in this big thing. But two, my daughter's a Russian area studies major. And I'm going to bring her as my guest. And I couldn't think of a better experience than to actually attend something like this, meet historic figures, you know, Anatoly Antonov, whatever you think about him, or Russia, arms control negotiator. He's the ambassador. And just to get the experience of the country, the politicians, the politics of that which she is studying. So I'll be there and I'll report back on Friday, Jeff, how it worked out.
Excellent. Well, we're going to have a great show Friday night, even better than usual. And things are looking up for you. It's all about directional movement, you know. Isn't that funny about life? Sometimes once things start moving in the right direction, it almost doesn't even matter what happened previously.
Yeah, but we just got to make sure it does this and not that.
Thanks to our beloved audience. See you Friday night.